All right, everybody, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. This is Radio Chaos, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. So there's been a big change-up in the Bush administration. Rumsfeld is out and has been replaced by Robert Gates. Generals Casey and Abizay are now out and are being replaced by William J. Fallon and David Petraeus. Zalmay Khalilzad, the ambassador to Iraq, is now moving to ambassador to the United Nations and is to be replaced by Ryan Crocker. And John Negroponte is leaving his job as the Director of National Intelligence to become the Deputy Secretary of State and is to be replaced by, I forgot his first name, a guy named McConnell.
Mike
McConnell as National Intelligence Director. So joining me on the phone to help clear some of this up and explain who some of these guys are is a 27-year veteran CIA analyst, Ray McGovern. He's the guy who used to brief President Bush 1 back when he was vice president in the Reagan years and is the founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You can read what he writes at tompaine.com and also antiwar.com/McGovern. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Thank you.
It's good to talk to you again, sir.
Right, Scott.
All right. So tell me first about this guy, Robert Gates, the new Secretary of Defense. I know that you're acquainted with him.
Yeah, actually, I'm more personally acquainted with him than with many others. Gates worked for me when he was a new analyst, a fresh fellow just out of the Air Force and college back in the 70s. And he worked in the branch that I ran on Soviet foreign policy, and he was a reasonably bright fellow, not as bright as some of the others I had in my branch, like Mel Goodman, for example, but reasonably bright. The only problem was that he was incredibly, and I have to say transparently, ambitious. So it was kind of a disruptive force in the branch, and as a new first-line supervisor, I thought that should be duly noted on his fitness report, which I did. And which I have never regretted, actually, even when he became director and I had to work for him. Ambition is the keynote for Mr. Gates. He will always trim his analytical sails to the prevailing winds from the White House. And those, like those sycophant senators who thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread back a month or so ago, those who think that Gates will have any voice at all in making a more reasonable policy toward Iraq, well, we try to tell them beforehand that those hopes are quixotic, are very ill-founded, given his record, and I think the events that have played out over the last 3 weeks prove that to be the case.
Well, first of all, you definitely weren't alone in your criticism or your summation of his character. It seemed that when he was nominated that virtually everybody who had ever worked with the guy said the very same thing that you just said, that basically he lives to be a tool of his bosses.
Yeah, that's how he made it up the ranks. And, you know, when he finally became confirmed after we tried manfully to disabuse senators of this hope that he might be, the kind of saving grace, my attitude was to, give the man the benefit of the doubt. He's been out of government for a dozen years. Let's see what he does. But, of course, the first thing he did was go out to Iraq and bring the president's new message to the generals out there. And those who didn't snap to and salute, as we know now, were summarily not executed, but they demoted or retired or whatever. And he's got a new cast of characters. Ironically, Gates, as I, was a student of Soviet history, Russian history, and what we've got here really is a Stalinist-type purge of the officer corps, the ones that are more professional than sycophant. And what we're in for now, if the press reports are anywhere near correct on the coming, quote, surge, better known as escalation, in Iraq, we're all in for big trouble.
Now, I really appreciate you pointing that out. It seems like the media, which I haven't been watching too much TV lately, but I haven't seen very much at all in print regarding the firing of General Casey and General Abizaid. I guess the press reports that came out said, well, yeah, they're being fired because they're not in favor of the surge. But, boy, it seems like that would have provoked a lot bigger reaction than it did. You compare it to a Stalinist purge, sounds right to me. Where's everybody else on this?
Well, you know, there's little to be expected from the domesticated media. I would make one correction. Casey was not fired. You know, he's been moved up. You promote people like that up to be Army Chief of Staff. Abizaid, of course, was going to retire, but he moved up his retirement by several months. So in one sense, you could say, well, if the president's decided on a new policy and the generals in place have already expressed themselves publicly as saying this new policy is a sheer idiocy, then it makes sense for the president to remove these generals. The question, of course, is whether the generals are right or General Gates, so to speak, following in General Rumsfeld's footsteps, thinks he knows more about what's necessary for Iraq than the generals who have been there for several years. I think that question answers itself.
Well, sure, and your recent article with Patrick W. Lang in the Miami Herald makes it perfectly clear your position on this troop surge. In fact, right there in the title, you say this will just be another mistake to add onto the list of mistakes.
Yeah, that's as mildly as we could put it. As Colonel Lang, who knows more about this kind of thing than most of us veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, as Colonel Lang puts it, you know, this is Stalingrad on the Tigris. I mean, if you throw in the majority of our reserve forces, you've got no more reserve, and so you've entered the battle to the end here. And if, as we are convinced, victory is unachievable, what have you done to the United States Army, for God's sake? Now, we're both retired Army officers, and we feel personal pain at seeing what's happening here. And so what happens if the North Koreans decide to have a little fun on the DMZ? The North-South Koreans are going to look to us, and there's nobody to look to. So spreading the Army and the Marines this thin is unconscionable, and one wonders what the president is. Well, I was going to say what he's smoking, but God help us if he's drinking again.
Well, do you think that? Well, I mean, I guess it seems pretty apparent that you don't think that Robert Gates would stand up to Bush on a question like this at all. That he would say, you know, to the new boss, hey, listen, I'm the new guy, so let me just go ahead and say I don't think this is a good idea.
Well, it's even worse than that, Scott. You know, Gates did have that 2-hour session with Bush out at Crawford before he was announced as the new defense secretary designate, and one can be sure that George W. Bush made it very clear to Bobby Gates what his new policy was going to be, that it was going to be a fight to the finish, that we would have a complete victory, and so forth. And so he would have had to, that is, Gates would have had to buy into this idiocy right there and then on the spot, but never being one to quibble with the masters, and quite frankly, eager to get back into the play, so to speak, having whetted his appetite by being on the Iraq survey group. And Gates did what he always does. Yes, sir, we can do this. And unfortunately, we're going to see the results of that kind of flexibility, if that's what you can call it, when the president makes his speech on Wednesday.
Now, basically, from all the press reports about this surge, basically, it's just a last-ditch attempt to try to secure Baghdad, right?
Well, let's not say surge. That's the rhetoric from the White House. Let's say escalation.
Right, surge makes it sound like it'll be over by summer or something.
Yeah, like an electrical power surge, which, by the way, the city of Baghdad could well use at this point.
Yeah.
It's escalation, and those of us with a little gray in our hair know what that means. Now, if you go back in history, right after the Tet Offensive, where the Vietnamese communists surprised everyone by attacking every South Vietnamese hamlet, not to mention city. After that, Westmoreland wanted to do his own search, and he had persuaded LBJ to field not 20,000, but 206,000 troops into South Vietnam to broaden the war into Cambodia, Laos, and perhaps even North Vietnam. And LBJ was apparently willing to do that until some patriotic truth teller leaked all those plans to the New York Times. That put the kibosh on it, and LBJ later told some intimates that he was prepared to honor Westy's request, as he called him, were it not for the New York Times publicity. This time, you have less troops, of course, only a tenth to 20,000, if that's the figure. But you have a bizarre situation where the mainstream press, far from being opposed to this or exposing it, is advertising it and saying, well, let's see, you know, let's see if we can't possibly leave Iraq, which is you know, nonsensical. Of course we can leave Iraq, and we're going to have to leave sooner or later, and that's the big point. You know, the damage is going to be there because of what we've done. Whether we wait another year with still more casualties, or whether we do it now, it's inevitable that there will be damage. And to think that this, quote, well, I won't even say it, that this escalation is going to turn things around is not only dumb, but it's criminally negligent, because it means the sacrifice of more of our young men and women.
Well, now, if I can just play Cheney's advocate for a second here. Well, what about the idea that if you get more troops in there, you can basically, clear and hold the areas of the Sunni insurgency and try to clear the Sunni insurgency out of Baghdad, suppress the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, and try to bring together a coalition government? Is there no chance of that at all?
Well, you know, I rely not only on Colonel Lang and experts like Larry Johnson from Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, but I rely on Abiy's aide and Casey until he got converted, and the other generals on the scene that say, no, this is not possible. What we have there is a civil war. And a full 8 months ago, the National Security Advisor, Stephen Hadley, admitted that. And he said, you know, this is kind of difficult because our troops are now in a civil war. It's not about insurgency anymore. It's about civil war. Well, what is the role of the United States Army and Marine troops in a civil war? Are they to interpose themselves between the two factions, go after one or the other? It's sheer idiocy. And the, you know, when people say, well, why does the president want to do this? The answer is very simple. This president, like LBJ, until people talk sense to him, doesn't want to be a president who loses a war. And so he's willing to send 20,000 more troops into the fray so that he can hang in there for what he hopes will be two more years. It's a forlorn hope. He's not going to be able to hang in Iraq for two more years, and yet, what the hell? He's going to try, you know? It's like a gambler. Double or nothing, you know?
Right.
Don't fold your cards when there's, you know, when there's some people like sycophants like Gates who'll say, yes, sir, I think we can do this. I think we can pull this off. And they'll get Petraeus and others that salute smartly and say, yeah, sure, we can do it. Why not try that? And, you know, if more people get killed, and I'm not talking only about Americans. You know, it's unconscionable that we don't even count the Iraqi dead, although most reasonable counts put them at over 600,000 who would be alive were it not for this war. So it's a feckless exercise. It's done for the basis of motives. And the question will be whether the Democrats have a spine implant that will enable them to say, no, the election proved the American people do not want this. And the only way that we, the Congress, can act according to our constitutional prerogative is the power of the purse, and we will not allow you, Mr. President, to spend more money throwing other soldiers after the first ones, and if they step up to that, and there are initial indications that Nancy Pelosi and others will, then there's some hope that we can get back into a carefully constructed and balanced government, which can make sensible decisions on key the issues like war and peace.
Well, but hasn't Pelosi already accepted the premise that it's a synonym, basically sending money or continuing to appropriate money and supporting the troops, that to stop, would be to stop supporting the troops?
Well, up until yesterday, you're quite right, Scott, but this morning's news has statements that she made yesterday saying that she will not fund, that she will be scrutinizing very, very carefully how the president means to pay for this escalation. And that's the big news. And that's, as you point out, a departure from what she said heretofore. But it's a hopeful sign that the Democrats realize that the president is trying to preempt their ability to stop this war by making his speech on Wednesday and then appealing to our patriotism to support it. What she's saying is, no, Mr. President, no one believes this is going to succeed, and we're prepared to consider, she hasn't promised to do it yet, but we're prepared to consider using our constitutional prerogative to withhold the funds for this kind of thing.
Right, which is still a whole other step from denying funds for continuing the war at the level it's at.
You know, well, you know, the point is, and most people don't realize this, there's enough funding already authorized to bring our troops home in a very considered, gradual way. The supplemental that's being surfaced now, I think it's $100 billion more, projects into the future. And so that's where the gauntlet is thrown, whether the Democrats have the courage of their own convictions and have the real interests of U.S. Army and Marine and Navy and Air Force personnel at heart remains to be seen. But what I'm saying is that over just the past week, we have encouraging signs that the Democrats, contrary to earlier expectations, are not going to let the president do this preemptive move without objecting, and objecting strenuously.
Well, times certainly have changed. I remember not too long ago there was antiwar.com and Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and seemed like pretty much everybody else was on board for this policy. And now you say it seems like really everybody is against it except Bush himself, because he doesn't want a legacy of failure to go down in the history books.
Yeah, the figure I saw this morning, Scott, was only 11% of the American people see any percentage at all in escalating in the manner that the president is about to propose. You know, it's a bunker. Well, I would say it's a gone bunkers bunker mentality that the president and Cheney are adopting here. They literally live in their own little world, surrounded by Condoleezza Rice, now Bobby Gates, and malleable generals who are more interested in their next star than they are in looking down at the welfare of their troops, and that I find unconscionable. In any case, we have, as we have always had with Bush, a little group around him. I call it a self-licking ice cream cone. Think of that image. That's what he's got, a bunch of advisors who will sniff the prevailing winds and tell him and Cheney what they know they want to hear. And I take some satisfaction in the fact that we Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity ended up our very first memorandum to the president 2 months before the war saying, Mr. President, we strongly suggest that you broaden the circle of your advisors beyond those clearly bent on a war for which we see no compelling reason and from which we believe the unintended consequences are likely to be catastrophic. Well, welcome to catastrophe, folks, because that's where we are now.
Ray McGovern, 27-year analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, founder and...
Co-founder of
Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. What about reports recently of more ships headed to the Persian Gulf? As they say in the media reports, to add pressure to Iran and other various media reports. Of course, the Sunday Times of London reporting just yesterday that Israel has a plan to start a nuclear war against Iran if America doesn't do it first. What do you think are the prospects for the expansion of this war, not just escalating it in Iraq, but escalating it to the neighbors, Iran and Syria?
Well, let me answer the Iran thing first. Sure, Israel has this plan. Dick Cheney, 2 years ago, right after the re-election of the president, made it clear that the Israelis might do that, might try to bomb the heck out of the Iranian nuclear installations. And rather than objecting to that, Cheney said, yeah, well, they could do that and leave it to the rest of us to pick up the diplomatic pieces, as though giving them carte blanche to do that. More recently, we've had several statements like that from various people. And the president himself has told the French prime minister that, you know, if Israel did this, well, he would understand. So the question is, Israel seems very hell-bent on doing precisely this. The question is whether they will deceive themselves into thinking that President Bush will stand by them and help them were they to start a war with Iran, or whether the president himself will tell them, you know, go ahead. Now, most people say, well, this is really, really crazy. This would be real sheer idiocy. Well, not from Israel's point of view. And the most disquieting thing of all is that the General Brent Scowcroft, security advisor to the first President Bush, found it necessary to say publicly that Ariel Sharon in those days has this president, President Bush, President George W. Bush, wrapped around his little finger, that he has him mesmerized. Scowcroft's word. Now, Scowcroft was canned right after that, but why would a respected national security advisor find it necessary to say that about an incumbent president? Well, I can only conclude that he believes that to be the case, and that worries me greatly.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that I guess is the number one repercussion of a war against Iran that immediately jumps to mind would be the loss of our army in Iraq. We have, you know, our American soldiers have spent the last almost 4 years installing the Shiites in southern Iraq in power. And if we turn around and wage war against Iran, won't our guys have to start the war in Iraq all over again, but against the Shia this time?
Well, it's even worse than that, Scott. We have a very exposed supply line between Kuwait and Baghdad. The Shia are all around there, and there is no question but the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Division could easily break that supply line and take the equivalent of not 52 hostages, but 100,000-plus U.S. hostages in Iraq. And what would the U.S. do then? Well, God help us, but I can very easily see people who are detached from reality, like Dick Cheney, saying, well, we have these mini-nukes, you know? Actually, we don't have any more troops, so let's use the mini-nukes. And that, too, worries me greatly, but it's not to be excluded, because this bunker mentality is an extremely dangerous one, and I see it prevailing with Bush and Cheney hanging on.
William S. Lind in the American Conservative wrote an article about that called How to Lose an Army in Iraq, where he said, you know, basically compared the Iraq situation to the greatest defeats in world history, and said that if they dig into Iraq with this escalation and then start a war with Iran, that we could lose our entire army, hostages maybe, but then again they could all just die.
Yeah, I would compare it. You know, it helps to know a little history, and I saw a self-styled historian here. Things that I would compare this kind of move to are Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812 and Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941. I mean, these are megalomania par excellence. And the problem is that neither Napoleon's nor Hitler's generals had the guts to say, you know,
I don't think this would be a real smart thing because our supply lines would be incredibly long and impossible to defend. So those are the analogies that come to mind here. You're quite right, Scott. This is a catastrophe in the making of monumental proportions.
Why would John Negroponte step down from National Intelligence Director to become number two at the State Department?
Well, I see three possible reasons. First and foremost, John Negroponte surprised a whole bunch of us by overseeing two honest national intelligence estimates. One of them, the key one, said Iran cannot possibly have a nuclear weapon for at least 5 to 10 years, probably 10. Now, that pulls the rug right under Dick Cheney, who, of course, is advertising a much more immediate threat and has been for 2 years now.
So you think perhaps he's been forced out?
Yeah, I think that there's sort of a mutual agreement. Negroponte sees the place falling apart. He doesn't want to be around when the surge comes, and he's an old diplomat. Why doesn't he go back and take this sinecure for the last couple of years of his career? Mm. I see that. There's also a report, which is very troubling, which contends, and it's by a very reputable reporter, which contends that Dick Cheney was leaning all over Director of National Intelligence Negroponte to broaden the eavesdropping on American citizens, and Negroponte, to his great credit, stood up and said, not on my watch, folks, not on my watch.
Do you remember who was the reporter who wrote that?
Richard Sale.
Oh, I didn't even see that. Is that a new one?
Well, it's sort of privileged information. I probably shouldn't have said it out loud here, but he's an old UPI reporter who has incredibly good sources with the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
And I dare say he wouldn't have put it on our email little network were he not to want it out. So,
okay, I'm going to have to get on that email list there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and now one more before we wrap it up here. Who's this guy Mike McConnell who's replacing Negroponte?
Well, Mike is just the guy for the job.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah. He's, I guess in all seriousness, I have to just tell whoever is listening that what McConnell's accession to power here in place of the civilian Negroponte means the virtual takeover completely of the U.S. intelligence community by the Pentagon. Years ago, CIA lost the ability to analyze imagery, one of the most important sources of intelligence that was ceded to the Pentagon. And of course, with all these other changes, and especially with a retired admiral taking over as the head of the whole intelligence establishment, it becomes militarized in a way that it's never been militarized since 1947. So that's the most important thing. The other thing is hardly surprising. McConnell is the kind of fellow that salutes meekly and does what he's told. Now, there's a really interesting vignette in Colin Powell's autobiography in which he explains during the Gulf War, when Mike McConnell was his intelligence general, the big problem, of course, was finding where these scuds were. 39 of them were shot off in the direction of Israel, and they couldn't find them because they're mobile. And lo and behold, one fine morning, the press had an interview with General Norman Schwarzkopf, who said, "We got them. We zapped 4 or 5 of those things, and we're on the way to being able to locate and destroy these scuds." So Mike McConnell went in, and he and Colin Powell were rejoicing when a message came in from Schwarzkopf's own troops, the imagery analysts, who were saying, "Sorry, folks, those weren't scuds. Those were Jordanian oil tankers." So Powell innocently called up Storm and Norman and said, "Norm, we have a report here that those weren't scuds at all. Those were oil tankers." And according to Powell's own account, this was met with such a string of invective and profanity that he had to hang up. And Storm and Norman called it back and said, "That imagery analyst doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. Those were scuds." And meek little Colonel Powell, although superior to Norman Schwarzkopf, said, You say there's Guds, Norm. There's Guds. And that's the word they put out with the press. The next day, CNN had vivid pictures, photographs of destroyed Jordanian oil tankers. Now, what did Mike McConnell do about that? I know that he'd warned Powell that they weren't scuds. I know that he didn't do anything to prevent Powell from acquiescing in what Norm Schwarzkopf wanted to do. And, you know, it would be really interesting in his confirmation proceedings. One should ask, well, what happened to that imagery analyst? What happened to the fellow that told the truth? Did he get a promotion? Or was he demoted, as most such truth tellers are? They ought to ask Mike McConnell that, because he stood by idly and watched the intelligence be corrupted by his boss. And that's a very, very terrible precedent, because his boss will be now be Cheney, and by extension the president. And so one can fully expect that these habits do not die easily. He will be saluting and telling the U.S. public whatever Cheney and the president tell him to tell us.
And at the very least, we have two more years of this.
Well, I don't know. I think the American people are becoming awake enough to realize that the people who framed our Constitution were incredibly farsighted. We know, in encapsulated form, we know that they said to themselves, look, we've done the best we can here, but human nature is such that inevitably, sometime down in the history of our country, there will arise a president who believes he can act like a king. And we need to craft into this very document language that will address an orderly procedure, an orderly remedy for that kind of situation. The remedy is called impeachment. Do not shy away from it. It is the legacy of our forefathers. It's the only solution to this current terrible situation, and it needs to be pursued.
And it's the most underused power of the Congress.
Well, we have to give this 110th Congress a chance to face up to this, because in a way...
Well, we see the big problem immediately is you have to remove both of them. Because if you remove Bush, then you get Cheney. And if you remove both of them, then it's basically Nancy Pelosi's coup d'etat and her installing herself as president, right?
Not a problem.
I'm okay with it. I mean, I'm the Pelosi fan, but I prefer her to Bush and Cheney. But is that possible, really?
Talk about damning.
To remove them both at the same time.
Talk about damning with faint praise.
Yeah.
look, impeachment is a process. And most people say it would take 2 years to do. But the very process would have an inhibiting effect on this king,
yeah,
on the powers that he thinks he can exercise without any restraint. And when we talk about torture, we talk about illegal eavesdropping and all these other constitutional infringements, we need to call him on that. And the only way to do that is to follow what the Constitution provides. And so I see that it may take a few more months, but I see that John Conyers and others will finally live up to their constitutional responsibilities, begin impeachment proceedings, and you can impeach them both. That's a sort of a red herring. You can go after Bush and Cheney at the same time. After all, they're joined at the hip in any case.
Yep.
And so I wouldn't worry about it. I just would worry about those who shy away from doing what the Constitution provides, indeed what the Constitution dictates.
All right, 27-year CIA analyst Ray McGovern, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Thanks very much for your time today, sir.
You're most welcome, Scott.